Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Is gone from myself, and no one's left.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and we're back with a brand new guest this week. But before we jump into that, don't forget, if you like what we're doing here, give us a nice 5-star rating, review, and share with a friend. As an independent podcast, that's the best way for us to get in front of new listeners. Also, for all things deconstructionist, check out our website at www.thedeconstructionist.com. There you'll find links to our social media, blog, web store, Patreon, and our entire back catalog of episodes that you can stream for free from the website. This week's guest is Dr. Muhammad Khalil. Dr. Khalil is professor of religious studies, director of the Muslim Studies Program, and adjunct professor in the College of Law at Michigan State University. His specialty is Islamic thought, and much of his research revolves around Muslim conceptions of and interactions with non-Muslims. He's also the author of several books, including Islam and the Fate of Others, The Salvation Question, and Jihad, Radicalism, and the New Atheism. And an all-around awesome guy. He was really fun to talk to. Fascinating backstory of how he went from dental school to becoming a religion professor. And hopefully this is just overall just a very educational episode and a way that just points at how we could all be better to one another. And just in general, like dispelling a lot of the misconceptions between religions. So without further ado, I give you Dr. Muhammad Khalil. Because I am hopeless. Do you? All right. Welcome to the podcast. I'm very excited to have my guest on today. Welcome, Dr. Muhammad Khalil.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Now, we should probably take a second to make sure that we differentiate between you and some other individuals with the same name. We can kind of tie this into your intro. Tell people a little bit about your work and what you do for a living.
Sure. So my full name is Muhammad Hassan Khalil. Or in Arabic, Muhammad Hassan Khalil. And I am a professor of religious studies at Michigan State University. And I also direct the Muslim Studies program at Michigan State. And I'm also an affiliated faculty in the College of Law. And I teach courses on Islam. And I work kind of close to where I was born. I was born and raised in this part of Michigan. I was born in Lansing, raised in East Lansing. My father was a professor of electrical engineering at Michigan State. My mother has had various jobs. She also has a degree from Michigan State in business. So I'm kind of back where I started. And my life path was an interesting one in the sense that I actually spent some time in dental school. And because of 9/11, I ultimately left dental school and went into my current field.
Wow, that's actually something I was going to comment on. Part of the reason I asked you to come on, listeners who have been around for a little while know that we've done a series in the past, years and years back, trying to bring representation on from other faith traditions, other religions, to largely kind of educate and dispel certain misnomers. And I remember I was in my undergrad, I was in college when 9/11 occurred, and I just recall there being a lot of obviously news coverage. And anytime something like that happens, the easy reaction is to demonize, find the bad guy, find somebody to demonize, while we're just in our feelings in the moment. Mm-hmm. But some of the negative impact of that obviously is that there are a lot of innocent people who get wrongly accused of things that, have nothing to do with them. And so, mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting. So what kind of drove you to make that career change? What were you seeing, I guess, that made you?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, 9/11 was such a challenging moment because, you know, I was born and raised here. I'm American, but I also have family in Egypt, and I was born and raised Muslim, still am Muslim. And so, you know, you felt like you were being pulled in a lot of different directions. And, you know, you, on the one hand, you have your fellow, you know, my fellow Americans that I grew up with, my friends that I grew up with, and they're looking at people who look like me in a very negative way. And then I'm also, you know, I remember before 9/11, I'd be, you know, really embarrassed if there was some negative news story about Muslims, because I knew people were going to be talking about it. And 9/11 was the ultimate bad thing to happen in an American context, on American soil, you know, at that point. And so it was really challenging trying to navigate through that. And ultimately, I was always interested in religious studies. I was always interested in the big questions of life, you could say. But my impression was that's not a real field to go into. That's not a real career path, because it's so hard to find a job. And so, but when I was in dental school, I was really only in it for the money. My orthodontist retired at 39, making $3 million a year. And I was like, okay, that's perfect. I can retire early and then study Islam and religion and philosophy and all that stuff. But ultimately, I just couldn't take it anymore. I would skip my dental school classes and attend lectures on philosophy, a lecture on the life of Jesus, a lecture on Islamic thought. And I just could not sit there and look at teeth all day, with all due respect to dentists. So and my undergraduate degree was actually in Arabic and Islamic studies. So, you know, I just took the courses to fulfill the prerequisites for dental school. So it was very natural actually for me to go into religious studies after that. And you know, I was at a point where I was, when I finally got a job as a professor, I was surprised. You're going to pay me to do this? I mean, this is what I love to do. This is great. So it was, ultimately, I'm glad I made that very difficult decision.
So, you know, obviously, like, there was some motivation behind, you know, switching career fields. And I would assume part of that motivation was, you know, to educate people, because of the way that you were sort of interacting with society and the way in which they were kind of like, you know, looking at you like, I don't know about this guy, you know, and all of this, mm-hmm. all this weird backlash that happened and we've seen this again, by the way, you know, we saw this after the pandemic with Asian Americans kind of taking the brunt of that frustration over the fact that, you know, this virus, you know, they think came from China. And so,
yes.
And so what was kind of your intent? What was your goal, I guess, when,
yeah, good question.
Switching.
Well, part of it is I wanted to educate. I wanted to, you know, to provide correctives to what I saw as clearly misinformation. But you know, part of it also was I wanted to know. I wanted to understand what is going on. You know, because there was this narrative that Osama bin Laden, he's a real Muslim. And all you other Muslims are wishy-washy, apologetic, liberal Muslims who don't really understand the religion. And so I wanted to take that claim and interrogate it and really grapple with it. And I wanted to understand, you know, am I missing something? Because this is not the Islam I grew up with. My father was the president of our Islamic center. My mother has a degree in Islamic studies, actually in Islamic law, to be precise. From an Islamic university. So, and we were always, you know, there's nothing unusual about us. So I didn't, you know, did we get it wrong? Did bin Laden get it wrong? I wanted to understand. And that's, I think, why 9/11 ends up being on the first page of both of the books that I've authored. I have one book looking at the question, what do Muslims say about the fate of non-Muslims in the afterlife? And the other issue is the issue of jihad and extremism, and looking at how some, in this case, new atheist writers talk about Islam and jihad. And so 9/11 is right there on the first page in both books. Just as I just was reflecting on this recently, I noticed that. And so, and I just made a documentary on 9/11. I'm finishing a documentary with two other filmmakers, looking at a U.S. Muslim named Salman Hamdani, who went out of his way to try to save people's lives on 9/11. And initially, there was suspicion that maybe he was a terrorist himself because he was missing. But then they found his body next to like a first aid kit. It's something that has really shaped my life. So I want to be very careful how I word this. It was obviously, you know, it's a day that remains to this moment very devastating. But it's also a motivator. It motivated me to understand what's going on. If there's misinformation, I want to correct that misinformation. And actually, what was interesting is in doing research, I was able to see clear examples of someone like Osama bin Laden twisting the tradition. And so I was able to confirm my suspicions, but they were suspicions. I had to be very careful, right? Because you don't want to have your suspicions guide your research. You want to be as objective as is humanly possible, recognizing that it's ultimately impossible. But I was able to identify moments where he twists the narrative. And that, I think, was actually... it was eye-opening, and it was kind of what I had always been wanting to look into and understand.
So go into that a little bit. What were some of the things that you, as you did the research, started to uncover about the way in which he was twisting it, as you say?
Absolutely. Well, first, let me say it was a very disturbing research project. I mean, imagine it's 2 a.m, my family is sleeping, and I'm sitting here looking at ISIS magazines and bin Laden statements. It was a very disturbing project. But in any case, I'll give you one clear example. In trying to justify 9/11, bin Laden has an interview with Al Jazeera. And the interview was shortly after the attacks, but the interview was aired a couple of months later, I believe. And in that interview, bin Laden is trying to justify the attacks. He says, "I know in our religion we're not supposed to kill innocent people." And by the way, he never out and out says, "I did it," but it's implied, you could say, in that interview. So he says, "I know we're not supposed to kill innocent people. However, if an enemy kills our innocent people," and he uses the term women and children, "if an enemy targets our women and children, then we can target their women and children. And this is based on the views of," and he goes on to mention 4 Islamic scholars. I'll mention their names very briefly: Ibn Taymiyyah, Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah, both are from the 14th century CE. You have al-Shawkani, who is close, I think, in the 19th century. And then you have al-Qurtubi, and I want to say 14th century, roughly. He mentions Al-Qurtubi, and he actually takes a moment to praise Al-Qurtubi. Al-Qurtubi is a very famous exegete or commentator on the Quran. And so he mentions these scholars to justify his claim that if somebody targets women and children in your community, you can now target their women and children. And what was remarkable about that is that I remember thinking, wow, I've studied these 4 scholars. I don't remember them ever saying this. And what was truly remarkable is not only did they not say it, the one that bin Laden took a moment to praise, or actually he asked for God's mercy, it's something that one commonly says for somebody who's passed away, like rest in peace, basically. The person he took a moment to highlight, Al-Qurtubi, explicitly says the exact opposite. In his commentary on Surah 5 or Chapter 5 of the Quran, verse 8, Al-Qurtubi explicitly says, and he even uses the same terminology, if somebody targets our women and children, we are not allowed to target their women and children, even if it caused us great harm. And when I saw this, I couldn't believe it, because usually you don't find something this clear-cut, this obvious. You know, usually you find something that you could dispute. And no, this was like clearly the exact opposite of what bin Laden was claiming. So that's I think, the best example I can come up with, actually.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Wow. Okay. So, there's certainly clear parallels in terms of examples that I could find within Christianity where someone twists, a scholar's interpretation of Christian scripture as well to use it for some nefarious means. So, I mean, we see this. Mm-hmm. We're certainly guilty of that too.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now. Save big money at
Menards. So one of the things that, I mentioned at the top is obviously, we are sort of cousins in terms of, from a religious standpoint, because we are one of the three Abrahamic traditions, obviously Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So talk a little bit about the history of Islam and sort of where we sort of branched off at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, as we know in the Bible, Abraham has two very famous sons, Ishmael and Isaac. And presumably other children as well, but these are the two famous ones. And Ishmael, according to the Bible, is going to be a father of a great nation and so on, but is not sort of celebrated like Isaac. Isaac, of course, has Jacob, and Jacob, of course, has Joseph. And then you go down the line, you get Moses, and then of course down the line you get Jesus, Moses and Aaron, and then down the line you get Jesus, and. But on the Ishmael side, the Muslim belief is that one of his descendants is Muhammad. And for all of these prophets, Muslims typically say, peace be upon that person. So peace be upon, in this case, Muhammad, peace be upon him. Jesus, peace be upon him. So Muslims believe that all of these individuals that I just mentioned are prophets of God, including Jesus, actually. Jesus is a very special prophet. And the mother of Jesus, Mary, or Maryam in Arabic, is actually mentioned more frequently or a greater number of times than in the entire New Testament. And in fact, there's even a whole chapter called Maryam, or Mary, which is chapter 19 or Surah 19 of the Quran. And the Quran even talks about how Mary or Maryam was is the best among the women, basically. Among all women, and as a role model for all those who are conscious of God, whatever their gender. And so, but with Mary in particular, she's so special, and it's probably not a coincidence that Maryam, which is Mary in Arabic, is such a popular name. Actually, my first daughter is Maryam. She's in high school now. And so that's my first daughter, it's such a beautiful name, and the story is so beautiful, Mary and Jesus. And actually, I even know some families where, I know a family where the first kid is a daughter, her name is Maryam, the second kid is a boy, and they named him Isa, which is Jesus in the Quranic Arabic.
That's remarkable.
Yeah. So, and Jesus is also a very special prophet, a very special individual. And actually, the Quran even, depicts him doing all kinds of amazing miracles and uses certain terminology that it does not use with other prophets. And Jesus is actually, peace be upon him, is so special that the prevailing Muslim belief, not that all Muslims believe this, but the vast majority of Muslims believe that Jesus is the one figure who will return before the end of time, believe it or not. And will even confront a kind of antichrist figure who is called the Dajjal in Arabic. So not Muhammad. Muhammad is very special, seal of the prophets, mercy to the worlds. But Jesus is the prophet who will return before the end of time. And so according to, again, to the vast majority of Muslims, I have to clarify this point because this point is never explicitly stated in the Quran, but it's in the statements attributed to Muhammad. It's explicit there. So that's, I think, one very special connection. And there's even a reference, if I'm not mistaken, to the Last Supper You know, there's a surah five called Al-Ma'idah, which is like a reference to presumably a reference to that meal. So a lot of similarities. Now, of course, also we have to be honest, major differences as well. One major difference is that Muslims do not believe Jesus is divine or the Son of God. So that's, of course, an obvious major difference. Another major difference is that, well, first of all, let me throw in a similarity first. Most Muslims, like most, but not all Christians, I understand, believe in a virgin birth. And even among Muslims, I'm not going to say 100% believe in a virgin birth, but certainly the vast majority do, based on how they read the Quran. So that's another similarity, at least among the, you know, looking at the majority of Christians. And I realize some Christians don't believe that. Now, going back to another major difference, the issue, I think, of the crucifixion stands out. And this is a very, very complicated issue. And I say that because of all the verses in the Quran, the one that I find to be the most challenging to interpret is the verse about the crucifixion, that passage. So it says that it's referring to some of the members of the Jewish community who are saying that they killed Jesus. And the Quran is responding to them, and it says they did not kill Jesus, nor did they crucify him, but it was made to appear like that to them. And then it goes on to make some other statements that I won't get into, but also require a lot of investigation and contemplation. But in any case, this statement is interesting. Now, is that denying the crucifixion, or is it simply saying that they did not crucify him? This particular Jewish community, that is the subject of some interesting debate and discussion. There are actually some Muslims, for example, some Ismaili Shi'i Muslims, who believe he was actually crucified, and that there even are some Sunnis who will speak of Jesus physically being, the body is on the cross, but they didn't get his spirit. Because there's another verse in the Quran that talks about the martyrs don't say that they're dead, they're alive, you just don't perceive it. And so based on that logic, Jesus is alive. He's not dead. Even if physically they got the body. That's again one interpretation. Now there are other interpretations, and some even talk about substitutions, like somebody's in Jesus' place on the cross. One very fascinating theory out there is that it's Judas of all people, you know. Yeah. So you get a wide range of claims, but ultimately these are claims that are not easy to resolve. And so there's this openness, and that's why I say it's one of the most, if not the most challenging passage to my mind in the Quran. And it's fascinating too, because, you know, the crucifixion and subsequent resurrection is such an important part of Christianity. And yet here is the Quran just mentioning it in passing in this one verse. And so now, you know, it's fascinating, and it requires a lot of investigating. And I'm still in the process of doing that.
Yeah, hey, we're still doing that with a lot, you know, with many places within the Christian Bible. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of debate, obviously, over a lot of components within there. So, definitely can identify with that. So, talk a little bit more about some of the, I think, misconceptions. I think that would be an interesting thing to dive into. You know, I'll throw out one to get us started, but like, I think one of the things I heard, because obviously Islam, as a religion, came kind of to the forefront in a way that it hadn't prior to 9/11. I'll be honest, I didn't really know much. I knew probably, I feel like in a lot of ways, even less after, cause I didn't know what was true and what wasn't. But one of the things that kept coming up, you kept hearing, oh, well, the Quran, is just this very violent book. And I'm like, have you read the Old Testament? I mean, you know, but, you know, I've gotten a little bit into, world religion studies, and I don't think that's true, obviously, but, talk a little bit about you know, that.
Yeah, I mean, this is the question I was grappling with after 9/11, right? This, so you talk about misconceptions. The issue of violence is obviously right there because of, well, not just 9/11, but 9/11 is the thing that really got people talking about this specifically at a heightened level. So, yeah, the issue of violence is complicated because, first of all, there are passages in the Quran that talk about peace and restraining yourself and passages that talk about warfare. And what I'll say here at the outset is that I would not remain Muslim if I thought that Islam was, was promoting wanton violence. So definitely that's something that I can say from my studies. I do not believe Islam is calling for wanton violence. I believe what Islam is doing is, and I have to be careful with the way I speak. When I say Islam is doing, my colleagues in religious studies will go after me. What do you mean by Islam? What exactly does that mean? But I'll say this, the Quran, as I read it, is not calling for wanton violence. I know there are some polemical writers who will promote exactly that claim, that the Quran is promoting wanton violence. And what I would just say is, I would encourage those individuals who are saying this and others who are just interested in the subject to take the time to read these passages carefully. You know, one of the challenges is you'll have someone, okay, they'll show you a verse from the Quran. For example, Surah 2, verse 191. Surah 2 or chapter 2, verse 191. And it says, kill them wherever you find them. Clearly a violent passage. But now the question is, did we take the time to read the verses before and after? And keep in mind, there are other verses that clearly are promoting peace and restraint and so on. So now what's going on here too? We have to think about the context. What is the context? And first of all, regarding the context, what the reports tell us is that you are dealing with an antagonistic community, primarily in Mecca, that has previously attempted to assassinate Muhammad. It has actually killed some Muslims who were pacifists. For example, the first martyr, most would say, is a woman named Sumayya, who is killed simply for her faith. And so the community actually has to leave Mecca and go to another city called, later it's going to be called Medina or Yathrib. And so you have this, these tensions, and you have what seems to be a state of war. That's the way I interpret it. And so you have this passage: kill them wherever you find them. But the verse before says, fight those who fight you, but do not transgress limits. So and actually, if you look at the Arabic root, so. The word is you are fighting those who are already in a state of warfare with you. They're already fighting you. Whereas before, when they were in Mecca, Muslims were not allowed to fight. They had to be pacifists. But now that they're in Medina and now that they are responsible for a community, the Quran says, how can you not, in another passage, how can you not defend basically these men, women, and children who are looking to you for protection? So the Quran is not calling for absolute pacifism, although it was calling for pacifism when Muslims were just individuals in Mecca. So as an individual, yes, I restrain, I hold back. But now that I am responsible for a community and I'm dealing with people who are already antagonistic, okay, now we have this violent passage, but even this violent passage is preceded by fight those who fight you, but do not transgress limits. And what are the limits? This is now where you get into all kinds of statements like, you know, do not kill women, do not kill children. Actually, this statement, do not kill women and children, is considered one of the 500 most reliable statements attributed to the Prophet that we have. And then the Prophet Muhammad. And then we have other statements like, do not kill the farmer or the monk or the person who's there on the battlefield just doing, you know, just like a servant who's just doing, you know, paid labor. And so you have all these qualifications, basically. And then you have other passages that say, even late in Muhammad's life, that, for example, there's a passage, Surah 8, verses 60 to 61. There's a passage about fighting, but then it goes on to say, but if they incline toward peace, you incline toward peace. In other words, the default is peace. You want there to be peace, but if they are already in a state of an antagonism, then you at that point you are now responsible for a community. So now it's okay to defend yourselves. Now, having said that, I should also point out that the tensions with the Meccan polytheists of Mecca, the polytheists of Mecca specifically, reached a point where conquest was basically what ended the conflict. And it was a kind of a fairly nonviolent conquest, actually, relatively nonviolent conquest of Mecca. Beyond this now, we're going to see a lot of debate as to how should Muslim communities function after this period, after the death of the Prophet. Should Muslims conquer lands and spread? Certainly, we saw a lot of that after Muhammad dies. But keep in mind, there are Muslims who disagree with this, who think this should not have happened this way. Even those who talk about spreading and conquering, even these Muslims, you know, they're living in a pre-United Nations world where the assumed state of relations between nations is one of war, unless you have a truce or a treaty. And so even those who speak of conquest, they will, in many cases, modify their views when thinking about the modern context. And even these people are usually not okay with terrorism. So the complicated thing, I think, is when it comes to this issue of, you know, conquest and the spread, the political spread, you'll find a lot of interesting debates there. But as for targeting innocent civilians, this is where you will find historically Muslims across the board overwhelmingly opposed to this kind of what we see basically with ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Those kinds of attacks, clearly rejected by the majority. And when we actually look at polling data, we see that Muslims overwhelmingly rejected 9/11. And now, having said that, I'll also say, and this is a long-winded answer, but I'll just throw in one more thing here. There's a poll that was taken by Gallup. I think it was published in 2009. And in that poll, they asked Muslims in 30, I think, you know, dozens of countries, tens of thousands of Muslims, the biggest poll ever taken after 9/11. What do you think about the 9/11 attacks? And overwhelmingly, people were opposed to it, either completely opposed or maybe they were partially opposed. But in general, there was not acceptance of what happened. Having said that, 7% in the poll thought the attacks were justifiable. That's an alarming number when you think about the population of Muslims. I mean, Muslims are almost 2 billion people now. So 7% is a lot of people. So that is very alarming. But here's what I think is interesting. When Gallup went a step further and asked, why do you think is justifiable? So they did this in Indonesia, for example, the country with the largest Muslim population on the planet. Right? Many people think it's Saudi Arabia or Iran, but it's Indonesia. And what was interesting is the people who condemned the attacks often gave religious reasons. Those who justified the attacks often gave political or non-religious reasons. In fact, not one person cited the Quran or a statement attributed to Muhammad or anything like that to justify the 9/11 attacks in Indonesia when they did this poll. And the last thing I'll say, because every time I say something, I'm imagining people now responding, well, what about this? What about that? One more thing I'll say. This is not to deny the role of religion in what happened on 9/11. Bin Laden, I believe, did believe in religion, did believe in a particular interpretation of Islam. I believe that. What I would also say, though, is that it was not the Islam, the historical Islam, or the prevailing, you know, interpretation or understanding of Islam today. It was a kind of aberrant, strange Islam predicated on, well, just to give these, like the example I mentioned earlier, misinformation, you know, twisting of the sources. So there is a religious component. It's just not a religion that's representative of the vast majority of Muslims.
Does God have a faith? Does he have a body or even a name? If he does he know that I'm alive? Is God even here? Does she care? His face must look like yours. Did God kill his kid? Did he have to have blood before he would forgive? Maybe we made a God that looks like us. Does God know my name? Is the ache in my soul just confined to my brain? Even so, does that mean it's not real? So take a breath. A face, her face must look like yours. A face like a Tina, an Ahmed or Mildred, a Russ and his husband, Gus and their children. Face like a Kim, a Ted or Tyrone, a Lucy born with an extra chromosome, a Pablo with legs he can't move by himself, a girl born a Daniel who now is Danielle, a Bill agent, even white guys named Todd. If you have a heartbeat, you are the face. love.